ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
There are a lot of perfectly sensible reasons to start a war. Territory, resources, pigs. Wait, what?
You've got to pay for that pig.
Yes, a pig, a pastry shop, a football game, sometimes even birds.
They don't seem to be easy to kill.
History is filled with some stupid wars. On the No One Saw It Coming podcast, we are diving right into them with me, Mark Fennell. Search No One Saw It Coming podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, this is The Science Show, and this week we are getting technological. We're looking at how artificial intelligence is helping people with dyslexia. Yes, a good news story about AI. Plus the telescope that started out as a spy satellite and which might solve some of the most profound mysteries of the universe. You're with me, Belinda Smith. And one of my favourite tech stories of late has been the World Humanoid Robot Games that were held in Beijing last month. If you can find footage from these games, I recommend you watch them. They're pretty amazing. One of the robots ran 100 metres faster than Usain Bolt, but it couldn't stop, so it smashed into a wall and had to get stretchered away. It's pretty funny, if not a little creepy. But my point is, technology and sport go hand in hand. But what about quantum technology? See, this one I find a little bit harder to get my head around. So I enlisted my ABC science reporter colleague, Jacinta Boller, to take me through how this might work.
You're in a room and the chief scientist comes up to you and whispers a crazy idea in your ear. What do you do?
Oh, it depends on what the idea was. I mean, I'm up for shenanigans, but I do have a line.
Are we going to find that line today?
Quite possibly.
Well, that is exactly what happened to Professor Warwick Bowen, a quantum physicist at the University of Queensland. He had this happen to him a couple of years ago.
Yeah, it's a funny story, actually. So the whole thing began in 2023 when Australia's chief scientist at the time, Kathy Foley, at a function, tapped me on the shoulder and said to me, "Warwick, I want the Brisbane Olympics to be the Quantum Olympics." And my reaction was, she's the chief scientist, so I'm positive. But internally, I'm thinking, quantum sport? How does that all work together?
I mean, that's a really good question. That's my question. How can you combine sport with quantum physics?
They don't seem like they go together.
It's a strange one, yeah. So the Olympic Games are being hosted in Queensland in 2032. But how are quantum physics and sport going to be combined for these games?
It is a weird one, and I don't think it's very intuitive. And Warwick didn't think it was intuitive either.
And so he's a physicist.
Yeah, this is his literal job. So quantum mechanics are the laws of physics that govern tiny little things. Atoms, stuff like that. It acts very different to the bigger physics phenomenon that we instinctively understand. Gravity is a great example. You drop a ball, you know what that's going to do.
An apple falls out of a tree.
It hits Newton.
Allegedly.
And so quantum mechanics is useful for some stuff, like, you know, X-rays, MRI machines, quantum computers. But the idea of them being useful in sport felt, look, I'm going to say it, a little gimmicky.
Yeah, I'm feeling that too.
And so I did put this to Warwick.
Many people in the quantum community would have viewed this as a gimmick. And my first reaction when Kathy Foley brought it up to me was that it seemed a bit gimmicky. But the reality is, for any new technologies, you need to find the early adopters. And so for quantum defense is a good example. You need to find the people who it really matters to get that better performance and who are willing to invest to make it happen. And it turns out performance sport is another one of them. And so it really isn't a gimmick. Many of the applications are around diagnostics of disease, of health, of performance. So quantitative diagnostics of concussion or measuring muscle fatigue or measuring iron levels in the blood, iron deficiency. These things really matter. And they matter more broadly than for athletics. They matter to our society.
All right, not a gimmick. So quantum could be used for health applications, which it's a great idea. Muscle fatigue and iron deficiency, as someone who suffers from both, I think that's fantastic. But how?
This is where it starts to get a bit in the weeds. So there's a bunch of technologies that are being trialled as part of the funding that went into this Quantum Games program. Its proper name is the Quantum 2032 Challenge, but I like calling it the Quantum Games because I think it's better. I'm going to focus in on the concussion project that Warwick and his team are working on to try and explain why you would even bother looking at quantum in the first place. So when your neurons fire or your brain releases chemicals, your body also produces something called a magnetic field. It's tiny. It's a very small magnetic field, but it can be measured by a device called a magnetoencephalograph.
Okay, so let me get this straight. So individual neurons, when they do something, they spit out a bit of dopamine or whatever, that also produces a tiny magnetic field around that neuron.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
This is obviously, again, very, very small, very little, yeah. But it means that you can work out if these things are changing when a concussion takes place. This is Dr. Eleanor Trimby, one of the researchers on the concussion project, explaining how it works.
If we can create magnetic field sensors that are sensitive enough and put them next to someone's scalp, then we can hope to pick up on those brain activity-related magnetic fields and actually gain an insight into exactly that, objectively how someone's brain is behaving and whether that behavior has changed following a head injury compared to how it would do on a normal day. So what I do for my project is work partly on the design of sensors that can be used to do this and partly on how we can integrate these into a wearable device that could be brought to the side of a rugby pitch or a football pitch to make those measurements and make that diagnosis pitch side.
So in the same way that a laser or an MRI machine needs quantum physics to work, a device can measure these brainwave changes and potentially concussion using quantum physics.
I mean, that would be so great if it works. As someone who plays community sport, concussion is a massive issue. Everyone's talking about it. But taking a step back from all this, how is concussion currently measured? Why would we need this at all?
If someone is currently suspected of having a concussion on the field, a trainer will pull them off and they'll ask them a bunch of questions to try and work out how their brain is currently functioning. They'll check if people have a headache, nausea, are confused, stuff like that. The issue is this is not an objective test. There's no like blood sample that can be drawn that tells you if you have a concussion. And that's what the team are trying to do with the quantum device. Now, I'm not going to lie though, this is not just a quantum thing. There are lots of different scientists trying to get a test that will objectively measure concussion. You've interviewed scientists that are doing this stuff.
Yeah, in mouthguards, little sensors that can measure forces in the head through a mouthguard that lights up if something's gone a bit too hard on
exactly.
The head.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is all happening. But this particular test would allow the team, well, hopefully, if they're confident about this, that they can work out those concussion changes using those magnetic fields in the brain.
Just a question about the magnetic fields. Are they looking for magnetic fields associated with damage or the emission of neurotransmitters?
There's not like there's a magnetic field for damage. What the team are trying to do is actually put people in the machine to do this before they go on the field and then afterwards. So you can tell the differences. This is very early stages. They still need to do the kind of controls to work out how this stuff works. But the hope is that you'd be able to see a change in that concussion because the brain is doing different things in that time frame.
Okay, so you're comparing the brain's tiny magnetic fields before and after a hit, and that's what you're using to gauge whether someone has a concussion or not.
Absolutely.
What does this contraption look like? Will we see it on the side of the MCG?
Yeah, in the 2032 games, obviously.
Sure.
Okay, so when I went up to Queensland, I actually got to see the prototype of this device, and it's a lot. So they had like three or four large concentric metal cylinders stacked inside each other like a babushka doll. So this is the shielding bit. And this is to attempt to keep out all of the other magnetic fields that people have to worry about.
Okay. What's generating these other magnetic fields?
Oh, literally everything.
Okay.
I mean, you know, your phone, for example, is going to be releasing significantly more stuff than this.
Uh-huh.
I don't want to be too mean. This is just a prototype. But Warwick explained what the proper version was going to look like. And it's, well, it's quite something.
If you used to go to hair salon and you would sit in one of these hair drying chairs and they would lower the hair dryer over your head, it'll kind of look like that. Because the helmet is heavy. It's maybe 300 kilos in the first go because we need the magnetic shielding, which hopefully will go eventually. And that will allow us to lower this helmet over the athletes without it putting any weight on them. And then we'll have a whole computer system inside the chair so that you can do the analysis in real time.
So they're aiming to test the prototype next year on the rugby team at the University of Queensland.
Huh.
So huge props to them for allowing these physicists to come in with this giant device to put over their head so they can test it on actual people.
Okay, so this is yet to be tested on humans, this device. So when they do finally start testing it on actual human beings, what's that going to look like? I don't know. It feels a bit space-agey to me. How big is this shielding at the moment?
It's so big. It's right. So big. So what they're trying to do is be able to put someone's whole head inside of this thing. Eleanor described it as a Ned Kelly mask.
Like a 44-gallon drum just plonked over you.
Yeah. The idea would be eventually that you could have this as a handheld device, but we are nowhere near that yet. The other thing that I find really interesting about this is that the tiny changes in the magnetic field, like they're obviously very difficult to measure for concussion. You've got to check before and after to work it all out. But it's more difficult because humans inherently are creatures that struggle to be still enough to be measured in this way. So the messiness of biology and the neatness of physics are kind of butting heads here. Here's Eleanor again.
It turns out that this is a very new problem for me as a physicist, that our bodies are emitting magnetic fields all the time in everything we do. So there's magnetic fields associated not just with brain activity, but also with muscle activity. And eye blinks can be included in that. So can heartbeats. Any kind of movement that might have a muscular element to it could technically count as noise in our data.
All right. So the shielding would then presumably stop everything below the neck from interfering with the device, which is measuring the magnetic fields within the brain. So that's your heartbeat taken care of.
Hopefully.
But what about your eye movements?
Yes. So you have to sit really still and don't blink. Well, actually, according to Eleanor, there is a slightly easier solution.
They can blink as long as they blink in a predictable fashion. But for sure, we can definitely, as soon as the technology is up and running, we can learn a lot about concussion. So whether it's possible to use it for diagnosis by the time the Olympics come round, unsure, but definitely it will be something that we can use for making, I guess, significant headway in understanding concussion better.
Significant headway. Great joke. Jacinta, thanks so much for bringing me this amazing story. I guess we'll find out in a few years if we'll see these Ned Kelly-type contraptions at the Olympic Games. Dr. Eleanor Trimby from the University of Queensland. And if you want more quantum science from Jacinta Bowler, check out the latest series of Science Friction called Dead and Alive. You'll find it on ABC Listen. So those quantum concussion sensors may still be years away, but a different type of ultra-sensitive detector will deliver results much, much sooner. I'm talking about NASA's Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope, which blasted off from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida 2 weeks ago and is now on its 1.5 million kilometer journey to its final orbital destination. I spoke to ABC science reporter Ellen Fidian about this new piece of astronomy kit. What makes this telescope different from the other space telescopes up there, Hubble and the James Webb Space Telescope?
It's exactly the same size as the Hubble Space Telescope. The mirror, which is the thing that collects all of the light in, is 2.4 meters, same size as the Hubble, and that makes it a lot smaller than the James Webb Space Telescope. But what differentiates it from both of them is its wide field of view. So the Roman Space Telescope isn't going to be able to see as far into space as the James Webb Space Telescope. It's not quite as powerful, but every snapshot it takes of the cosmos is about 100 times the size of what the James Webb Space Telescope can do. So it's these much more wide-angled pictures, and they're also a lot wider than Hubble as well. It also looks in a different part of the spectrum to the James Webb Space Telescope. So it's slightly higher energy infrared and visible light. So the idea is it's going to be taking these kind of big panoramas and looking for unusual stuff, stuff that changes quite quickly like supernovas, and then theoretically stuff that the James Webb Space Telescope can zero in on a bit more.
Okay, so these telescopes will work together in essence.
Yeah, the idea is that they're designed to be really complementary.
What are the main scientific questions Roman is hoping to answer?
There's three big ones. The first two are dark matter and dark energy, these very, very weird physics phenomena that we don't fully understand, or we don't really understand at all. One of the ways we can learn more about both of them is seeing how galaxies are distributed across the universe and how they're moving, because that will give us information about what's sort of driving them to move, the gravity and the energy that we can't necessarily see. And so the Roman Space Telescope is going to be really good for this because it takes these big pictures with its wide field infrared instrument. It's going to have these like really large galactic panoramas, basically, that can tell us a lot more about how they're all structured and shaped, and basically theoretically build up this kind of three-dimensional map of the universe. So that's one of the things it's going to be really useful for. The other big one is exoplanets. So the Roman Space Telescope has another instrument on it called a coronagraph, which helps to block out light from stars so that you can see really faint objects around it. Lots of space telescopes have them, lots of ground telescopes have them, but the Roman coronagraph is one of the most delicate instruments ever built. And it's going to help us find a lot more exoplanets around other stars. So it's going to be carrying out these huge exoplanet surveys. It's not quite powerful enough to see exo-Earths, so really small planets like the Earth, but it will be useful for seeing things like exo-Jupiters, so gas giants that are a long way away from their stars, whereas most of the time, most of the exoplanets we're finding at the moment are really big and very, very close to their stars that they're orbiting.
So is it hoping to directly image exoplanets?
Yeah, that's the idea. And one of the astrophysicists I talked to compared the delicacy of this coronagraph to looking for a luminescent bacterial cell on a lighthouse from several kilometres away.
So oh, wow.
You've really, really got to have something very, very powerful to be able to do this.
I've read that the Roman telescope was a repurposed spy satellite. What's its origin story?
It's a really weird one, actually. So it's one of two space telescopes that was donated by the US National Reconnaissance Office, the NRO, to NASA in 2012. And they basically just announced it one day, said, hey, we have these two space telescopes. They're the same size as the Hubble. They're, you know, as powerful as the Hubble. Do you want these? It's a very weird origin story. We know the NRO was interested in these satellites for Earth observation. They were presumably going to be using them as spy satellites, but the project got too expensive for them. And so once they had these leftover spy satellites, they ended up sending them to NASA because they thought NASA might as well be able to use them.
Fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. It's something that they've always kind of known the NRO is up to. The reason the Hubble was the size that it was because it was easier to make that mirror because there was already expertise in making mirrors of that size. So it's something that's always kind of been linked to the US military and their space observation.
So presumably, if the NRO was using them, the telescope would be pointed the other direction, not away from Earth, but towards Earth.
Yes, exactly. And there's still discussions about what to do with the second of the two telescopes the NRO donated. There's talk about maybe they could send it to the moon, maybe they could send it to Mars. And there's a suggestion that they use it for scientific Earth observation because it's supposed to be really good at that because that's what it was made for. Mm. So yeah, they were originally designed to be pointed at the Earth, but NASA repurposed the Roman Space Telescope and sent it into space. And it saved them probably about $250 million on the project. So it did make it much cheaper to put this telescope together.
Oh, love a good recycling story. So who is Nancy Grace Roman?
Nancy Grace Roman was the first chief of astronomy at NASA. In the 1960s and 70s, she was also the first female executive at NASA. And she's kind of got this nickname as the mother of Hubble because she was the person who really, really pushed for space telescopes in the first place. She said to be able to get out of the Earth's atmosphere is just going to make us so much better at astronomy and so much better at understanding the universe. So she was one of the first real forces behind the push for a space telescope and the push eventually for the Hubble Space Telescope.
So the telescope, it launched in August. When can we start seeing pictures?
So at the moment, it's travelling out to its deep space destination. It's going to be orbiting the sun the same place as the James Webb Space Telescope. a point called L2, where the Earth's gravity kind of balances so it doesn't need that much power to orbit the sun. And it's going to take about 3 months to get there and for all of the commissioning and tests to be complete. And then at the end of those 3 months, that's when they're going to start releasing their first look images and they're going to start the scientific observations. So probably end of November, early December, we can start to see some really spectacular pictures coming out of Roman. And they're also going to be releasing all of their scientific data that they collect immediately. They have this open skies policy that means any astronomer, but also just any person can use the data straight away to start making observations and learning things, which is quite cool.
And I remember the first images that came back from the James Webb Space Telescope, they were so beautiful. I remember Joe Biden launched them. So for the President of the United States to be the one that unveils these images, it's a pretty big deal. Are we imagining that the Roman Space Telescope will deliver similar kinds of images, like in terms of spectacularness?
Certainly in terms of spectacularness, yes.
That's
absolutely
a good word.
Yeah, it can't, like I said before, it's not quite as powerful as the James Webb Space Telescope. So those first images were things like, oh, you know, these are really, really old galaxies. They're from close to the birth of the universe. We're probably not going to get quite that close from Roman. My guess would be we'd be getting much larger vistas because that's kind of its job to take these much bigger pictures. I don't know what they're going to be releasing first, but that would be my guess.
And how long is its mission going to last for?
They've got a planned mission of 5 years and then an extension of another 5 years. And then possibly it could go for longer than that. The limit on how long it can go is fuel. And they've designed it to be refuelable, but they don't at the moment have a refueling mission planned.
They've got a spare satellite in the back storeroom, so NASA could send up another one to replace it, I guess.
Yes, exactly. And it's being launched at a point when there's, particularly in dark energy, a lot of debate going on. We might have to be sort of reworking our models of the universe, so there could be really good reason to want to refuel it and take some more observations.
What excites you the most about this mission?
I think it's launched at a really timely time, like I said, for dark energy research in particular. A couple of the ground-based observations are starting to suggest that our sort of working model for what we think dark energy is could be wrong, which means that our working model for how the universe started and expanded could potentially be wrong.
So dark energy is the phenomenon which astronomers think is driving the expansion of the universe. It's making galaxies fly away faster, away from each other, accelerating. This is what won Brian Schmidt the Nobel Prize.
Exactly. That discovery was made with the help of the Hubble Space Telescope. So Hubble was instrumental in that initial discovery of dark energy, the idea that the universe was accelerating in its expansion rather than slowing down. So since then, there's been this working model that dark energy is a constant and it's making the universe accelerate at a constant rate. Most recent observations from a couple of big surveys have started to suggest that dark energy could actually be changing over time. It could be getting a bit weaker. And so that means that we'd have to come up with a new model for how the universe is expanding and how it was working. And Roman's designed to help deal with that. So it's going to be collecting a lot more data on how these galaxies are moving and hopefully either refute the findings from other surveys or confirm them. And then we'll have to toss out our sort of working model of the universe, the Lambda CDM model, and come up with something else, which I think is really exciting. Hubble helped with a really big paradigm shift in this space. So Roman could be helping with the next big paradigm shift.
Oh, I'm excited to see it if it happens. Thank you so much, Ellen, for talking to me about the Roman Space Telescope.
No worries. Thank you, Belle.
Ellen Fidian. You can find Ellen's reporting on the Nancy Grace Roman Telescope online and Nobel laureate Brian Schmidt discussing the dark energy dilemma with Robin back in May. There are links to both of these in the show notes. And this is The Science Show on ABC Radio National. From the chilly reaches of space to the blue mountains of New South Wales now, where there's a rescue mission underway to save an endangered shrub. But this plant's main threat isn't climate change or habitat loss, no. It's fertility. Shelby Trainer tagged along on a field trip with the scientists trying to save it.
People were like, oh, so what are you actually going to do? And I was like, I think it's kind of like plant IVF, but I'm not sure if that's really off.
It's exactly how I explained it to my partner, basically. We have some plants that potentially can't make babies, and so we're looking for suitable sperm donors, and we're using those. We're planting them onto the female flowers, and then we're seeing if we can make babies. And he's like, oh, I get it now.
I'm at Narrow Neck Peninsula in the Blue Mountains on a warm December day, about to visit an endangered shrub, Zaireia kevenii. It's an ordinary looking shrub with oily leaves that erupts into small pink and white flowers. It can grow up to 2 meters tall. But the population I'm about to visit is struggling. Ecologists are pretty sure its pollen is sterile, meaning the male structures of the plant are infertile.
What I usually say is, these plants are shooting blanks. So that's why we're looking for sperm donors.
According to Angelina Ellis, an honours student from the University of New South Wales, this population hasn't been known to fruit or produce seed. But there is another population of Zaireia kevenii a few kilometres away that can. So Angelina is taking the pollen from these healthier shrubs and hand-fertilising the struggling ones. Like she said, sperm donors.
Essentially, we're pollinating the plants in like a controlled way. So we're taking the pollen from the plants that we want to use and placing it onto receptive stigmas.
The stigma is the female reproductive part of a plant.
So this is kind of an experiment to see if we can get them to start reproducing via seed.
It has been 2 months since this plant IVF was undertaken, and we're about to find out if it worked. And the stakes are high. This is one of only two populations of Zaireia kevenii in the world.
A lot of species are endangered because of development, land clearing, climate change. But this species is unique because actually it's threatened with sterility, or what we believe is sterility. But it hasn't been really assessed properly yet.
This is Dr. Chantelle Doyle, one of Angelina's supervisors.
So the project that we're working on is to work out how sterile is sterile. Are there any plants that actually have viable pollen? And that's the male part of the flower. And then if we find plants with any viable pollen, can we use those plants to help cross-pollinate and create seed with plants that are sterile and not creating any seed currently?
So what are we actually looking for today? Bags have been placed over the shrub's flowers. If the fertility treatment has been successful, over the past 2 months, the plant would have borne fruit. The fruit would have dropped into the bag, broken down, and left a seed in its wake. That's what we're looking for.
They'll be quite obvious in the bag, though.
I've been told the seed will look like fly poo, but I don't know what fly poo looks like, so Angelina shows me an example.
That is seed.
Oh, that is so obvious.
Yeah.
The seeds are just like black sesame seeds.
Yeah, that's a good shape to explain it.
Black sesame seeds is much better.
Now that we know what we're supposed to be looking out for, we head off into the bush.
So it's legitimately very exciting to be here because we actually have no idea if we're going to get seed or not. If we find seed in our first bag, we will be very excited. But as the day goes on, our mood may shift one way or another.
You might be wondering how this population of Zaireia kevenii is still here if it doesn't sexually reproduce. Well, it does asexually reproduce via something called root suckering. This is where shoots grow from the root of the plant. But those shoots are clones. They'll grow up to be identical to their parent. So there's little to no genetic diversity between them. In fact, the population we're visiting now is a colony of clones, a group of genetically identical individuals. This leaves the population incredibly vulnerable.
Plants that do this thing where they clone themselves, it's a really good adaptation to colonising and persisting in an area when the habitat and the climate is optimal, and they'll perform really well. But then when it shifts, they don't have any genetic diversity to adapt. But the interesting thing is a lot of them that clone seem to go down this pathway where they start getting sterile pollen. It's kind of a chicken or the egg. Is it species with the ability to clone themselves start getting sterile pollen? Or the only species that keep going after they get sterile pollen are the ones that can clone. We don't know.
Yeah, is the cloning an adaptation to sterility?
Or they've dispensed with sexual reproduction because they don't need to. Or are they just the ones that we still see because they've hung on?
We go off trail in search of the shrubs. In the end, they're easy to spot. They're topped with organza bags, looking like upside-down wedding favours.
They allow light to still come in while also excluding any pollen vectors, so other pollinators, flies, whatever else. But it just means that they can't get in and they can't screw up our study, basically. So we know exactly where the pollen, we've got it, all the data recorded, like where we've gotten the pollen from, what plant is the donor, what treatment we're trying to apply.
There are several treatments as well. Each bag is assigned to a different one.
So we've got ones that are just to see if they can self-pollinate without a pollen vector at all. So if the flower itself can drop pollen onto the stigma and fertilise and produce a seed. And then if we can take it from other plants within the same population. And then we have from the other population, which we went to yesterday. So that'll tell us different things about how the plant can reproduce, basically.
Our job is to collect the 100 organza bags, looking for seeds. For the most part, what we find are spent flowers that have dried up in the hot sun. There are also pesky bugs that almost look like seeds until they start moving.
So basically with these ones so far, they haven't even produced a fruit. The flowers have opened. It's really weird. The female part of the plant works. It's the male part that's failing. So they produce a flower that is receptive and it has nectar. And it has pollen.
And it attracts pollinators.
But then it just drops off and never produces a fruit and the seed never develops in it because it doesn't get fertilised.
Which is why genetic rescue is something that can work, because even if the plant's associated with male sterility, a lot of the time the female function of the plant can still work, which is why just outsourcing the pollen from a different population could be a viable strategy.
Genetic rescue is the more accurate term for this plant IVF mission. The aim is to restore genetic diversity in the species, making it more resilient.
We'll see. We'll see in this specific context.
Has it worked before in other contexts?
Yeah.
What was the plant ID, sorry?
212.
Chantelle was right. As the day goes on, the mood does start to shift from hopeful to, well, let's just get on with it.
Sorry.
There are a few moments of false hope.
Well, it's really hard to tell.
If you're not certain, then the answer's no is usually how I go with these things.
One of the complicating factors here is that the fertile pollen was collected from plants 6 kilometres away. And it's not a quick and easy 6Ks to traverse. The fear is the pollen might have degraded in some way during the transition, becoming less viable.
There you go. Sad.
But we didn't miss anything. No,
we haven't missed anything here.
The day has been long and hot, and we haven't found any seeds. But we did find a few flowers still intact. That's good news for Angelina. She rebags them so she can come back in about a month to see if they fruit and produce seed. It's the final chance for this particular IVF attempt. And a few weeks later, in the new year, I received this audio file.
Okay, Angelina, tell me what you got.
We have a single seed in the entire narrow neck population. We have a single fully developed seed.
Yay!
Evidence that they can set seed. It's not futile.
Yay!
But there's a curveball. This particular plant didn't actually receive IVF. It was a control, which means it was pollinated entirely naturally. By what? They have no idea.
Yeah.
Who's your
daddy?
Papa.
The important thing is, this means the population isn't completely sterile. It is capable of reproducing via seed.
The things ecologists get excited about.
There's a lot more to be done. Angelina, Chantelle, and the wider team are taking a closer look at the plant's pollen to see if they can pinpoint the exact moment the pollen fails and goes sterile.
It's like the great mystery, isn't it?
Yeah.
One single seed in the entire population.
All right, we've got to not lose this bag.
Dr. Chantelle Doyle and Angelina Ellis from the University of New South Wales speaking to Shelby Traynor for The Science Show, which you're listening to right now with me, Belinda Smith, on ABC Radio National, where voting is now open for the top 100 Australian books. To get your vote in, head to the Radio National website or ABC Listen and look for Top 100 Books, or text the word bookworm to 0418 226 576 and you'll receive a link to the voting page. But not everyone reads the same way, and for the 10% of Australians who have dyslexia, it can be a real struggle. There are books available that have been edited for dyslexia, as well as graphic novels and audiobooks. There's lots of ways to consume books. But how can technology help?
I often say I wish I asked my mum why the B's and D's moved on the page for me, because maybe I would have been identified as a child instead of an adult.
Dr. Shay Wassell has spent a large chunk of her life not knowing she has dyslexia, but in hindsight, the signs were all there.
I was diagnosed actually at uni when I was doing my master's.
Wow, so you got through a whole undergrad.
I got through a whole undergrad of speech pathology. And it was only at uni that I really started to struggle because I couldn't say or pronounce the big words in neuropsych or when we're studying the brain. After qualifying as a speech pathologist, I was quite badly bullied. So I went back and did my master's. And that's then I had a tutor and she said, I think you're dyslexic. And that's when I got assessed at La Trobe.
These days, Shay is director of Rethink Dyslexia, an organisation that helps people aged 16 and over with dyslexia and other neurodivergent conditions. Dyslexia is, at its core, difficulty in reading and spelling fluency. But this also means difficulties in many aspects of everyday life.
Dyslexia, some people say it's a superpower. For me, I would not say it is at all. It's a lot of energy, I think, that people don't see. So not just in how I read, because I'm slow at reading, and I have dysgraphia as well, so I'm slow at writing also. But I think day-to-day activities like getting somewhere on time, not getting lost, reading a recipe can go haywire at dinner time, and then we've got to order takeaway because I haven't read it properly. So there's lots of different day-to-day activities that it can impact as an extra layer of exhaustion that people often don't see.
And this is primarily due to differences in how a dyslexic brain processes language compared to a neurotypical brain. Like so many conditions, genetics plays a large role in dyslexia's development, as does the environment. This is Dr. Beck Marland, a dyslexia researcher at Victoria University.
So the experiences that somebody has at school, so if they have good quality reading instruction, if they have a literacy-rich environment, they're less likely to have significant barriers, but they still might experience those barriers.
So nature and nurture, a little from column A, a little from column B. So what are some of the assistive technologies that exist for people with dyslexia and how do they work?
So for school-aged children, there are a range of reading and spelling programs that can be like AI assisted and apps. And then you have your text to speech and speech to text type of tools.
Okay, so how do they work?
So for children who are trying to sound out the phonics inside the words, there are lots of AI tools now available to support with that. And then when it comes to their writing and their spelling and their reading, there are tools to help with that as well.
And what about for adults?
AI has been a game changer.
Dr. Shay Wassell again.
And I think there's positives and negatives to AI, but I think for me there's never been a better time to be a dyslexic dysgraphic with ADHD because AI has just changed the way I work. So I'm able to work independently now. There's often not many spelling mistakes in the work that I do.
Can you give me an example of a task that has been made easier through AI? How long would it take you to do beforehand and how quickly can you do it now?
An email could take 2 hours. It could be a simple paragraph, but making sure you've spelt everything right and you've got your thoughts on paper properly, and it will still come back with mistakes. Now I've got Copilot built in so I can put my email in. It will fix up the spelling and grammar within 2 minutes. But writing reports as well, like the ability to scaffold my thinking so I can verbally dictate into Copilot. It can pull it into a draft form for me. I can check it. I've always had to have 2 people at least read my work. So it used to be my mum or my auntie or a co-worker, depending on where I was. I don't need that anymore as well. So that extra pressure that I used to have to put onto people to read my work quickly in a fast-paced environment where you didn't want people to know you had dyslexia, that pressure's gone. There's a range of tools that we also work with our clients as well. So read and write is one that has text-to-speech, speech-to-text functionality.
It also has a dictionary. You're able to colour code. So lots of things that can help us with reading and reducing some of that sensitivity that we can have with lights or colour when we're reading a screen. And these are tools that help everybody, really. It's not just someone that has dyslexia or dysgraphia. They're tools that if everyone in the workplace has access, then it kind of lifts everyone's level up of performance because it gives us an independence that we don't often have. And so for us, you know, even Siri, finding my way here, being able to text people using speech-to-text instead of having to type is really fantastic for me. It's not always accurate, but neither is my typing, so it doesn't really matter, but it's much more accurate than when I have to write something. So there's lots of tools now that have just been life-changing for me.
Mm. Can we talk about the colour coding side of things? Tell me about that.
For some people, having the colour change from white because of the glare, so having a softer colour, like a lighter yellow can be, like cream as an example, can be helpful for some people. And some people have Irwin syndrome, which is a different, it's not dyslexia, but that colour lenses that we can sometimes see can help people as well. But for us, the colour coding can also just chunk things, so breaking it up and being able to visually see differences can be really helpful as well.
So would that change the colour of sentences or paragraphs? Or
in Microsoft, they've got Immersive Reader, so we often show people free accessible tool where you can change the whole colour of the screen.
Oh.
So when you're writing, it's got a whole array of different colours. So that helps with the glare for some people, and it also can help some people, the words will move on the page. It's not for everybody. And so that can sometimes help settle that visual movement for them. For me, sometimes I'll just change it to a cream, but it's more the glare rather than the, it doesn't stop the B's and D's swapping for me. Mm-hmm. So I think everyone's different in how it helps them. It doesn't help everybody.
Beck, you do work into wearables. Can you explain what that research entails?
As a part of assistive technology, many people now are using smart glasses, which have received quite a bit of media attention recently.
Yeah, not great media attention.
And also note-taker devices. So note-taker devices, probably fewer people know about, but they're usually worn around the neck and they take notes, which enable you to have a transcription of a conversation. So these kind of devices can be very supportive for somebody who has dyslexia, but again, they carry some of the privacy risks and controversies that smart glasses have, such as the fact that they're always on, always recording, always capturing data. But there is another side to that story, and that is the fact that they're assistive technologies to support people with a disability.
Can they be combined with AI,
yes,
potentially for dyslexia? Yeah. Yep. Can you tell me about the projects that you're working on?
The projects that I'm working on at the moment are looking at policies for assistive technologies and how they can be balanced against privacy and risk concerns. So these are emerging projects.
Just with the smart glasses, would that be you would look at a page and it could read it to you? How would that work?
At the moment, the capabilities of smart glasses, again, are emerging and their capabilities are changing all the time, and it depends on what particular brand we're talking about. But in terms of being an assistive technology, rather than actually reading the page, they do allow you to connect to other apps. So you might, for example, be able to listen to an audiobook through the glasses in ways that are sort of unobtrusive and unseen. So rather than actually it being really known to everybody that you are receiving this feed via your glasses, you're actually receiving that information in a discreet way.
It's a bit more subtle than wearing headphones or something like that. With AI, it's rare, I guess, that we report good stories about AI and how it actually helps people. What do you see for the future of AI?
Well, I think for dyslexics, it gives us an opportunity that we've probably never had before in the way that we can work and demonstrate our skills and abilities in a way I think that we haven't been able to before. So I think, I don't know, I mean, people are saying that, you know, neurodivergent people in general are going to lead the way in certain things, and I feel for dyslexics it's giving us an opportunity to lead or just to be seen in an organisation where we haven't been able to before because we're not having to hide because we've got these tools that can articulate what we're trying to say on paper. Part of it's being taught how to use these tools because it's like anything, you've got to learn how to use it properly. When we work with people, you know, we're still the subject matter experts. Claude's not or Copilot's not. Mm. So you still need to be able to check your work. So whether it means that we get the opportunity to be in more leadership roles in a more visual way where people know that we're dyslexic but we've got the tools, we don't get that opportunity at the moment. for me, it's a really exciting time. We've used it to create a product that we're now in user testing for, something I'd never been able to do before. So I just see a lot of advantages for us as a community if we're able to access it.
So AI can remove many barriers for people with dyslexia, or at least make those barriers easier to overcome. But Shay's concerned that the people who might benefit the most are least able to get access to these technologies.
My hope is that everyone gets access to it, because it's like anything, isn't it? There's a privilege that comes with getting access to new things. And I think that we are in an environment where there's a risk of digital illiteracy happening faster, because we're seeing what's happening in the world around us with fake news. And one of the risks when you can't read is that you can be easily influenced by other materials, because you don't have the ability to fully analyse or critically think about something sometimes. And so with what's happening in the world around us, making sure people are educated and they've got the skills to use these tools is really important, but that everyone is able to access those as well.
There's a notion of digital poverty. So the idea that some people can access a higher quality version of AI and other people can't access those versions, or they can't access AI tools at all. So we don't want to see a situation where we have people who are experiencing this digital poverty and that they actually do have the right to these tools. A hope I have for the future is that the voices of people with dyslexia are heard more, so both in schools and at adult voices, so that we can hear from those people what it is that they want to see in education systems and in the workplace that can improve their lives and their experience.
Dr. Beck Marland, a dyslexia researcher at Victoria University in Melbourne. Technology can affect how we read in lots of different ways, and social media algorithms are no exception. They can subtly, or not so subtly, push and pull you towards various books and even genres. Amy Briggs looked into how social media shapes not just what we read, but what gets published.
There are plenty of ways to find a new book, from perusing bestseller lists to asking a friend for a golden recommendation. But in the last 6 years or so, more people say they turn to social media to find their next read. And online communities have helped shape what readers pick up and what is now being published. According to the latest Australia Reads survey, around 80% of Australians read a book at least once in a year. And of those readers, 8% have found books through book-related social media. By far the biggest and best-known social media book community is on TikTok, and it's known as BookTok. Anyone can post a video with the BookTok hashtag, and right now there are 85 million BookTok videos. Overseas, it's incredibly popular, with half of 16 to 25-year-olds in the UK having turned to the platform for a recommendation. But what does it mean to have a book recommended through a social media algorithm?
So the way I would describe what an algorithm is, pretty much just a set of instructions or a recipe to do something.
That's Mark Cheong, a social media algorithm researcher from the University of Melbourne.
Basically, my engagement is of high value to a social media platform. It's in the interest of a social media platform to then get me online more often, using the app more often, scroll through or doom scroll more often, so that I better align with advertisers. So when it's demystified, it sounds a bit just complex and boring, but to many people out there, the common use of the word algorithm is basically how these big tech providers use data to craft certain rules to do things to our feed, for example.
The TikTok algorithm combines user habits, videos that you've liked, watched, commented on, and your demographic information to shape what books and genres you mostly see in your feed.
It's often called the last wholesome place on the internet.
That's Eleanor Spencer-Regan, a researcher of children's and young adult literature, also at the University of Melbourne.
It is generally a very healthy community on the internet, that it feels like a safe space for teenage girls and young women, and particularly young women that identify as LGBTQIA or as being a person of colour. They are overrepresented in BookTok communities.
This goes part of the way in explaining why the titan genres of TikTok have come to be romance, romantasy, that's romance and fantasy, and young adult fiction.
The Empyrean series by Rebecca Yarros is a great example of that. It's got all of the ingredients for an incredibly successful series.
In many romance and romantasy books, there is an element of categorising books for what readers may like through tropes. Things like an enemies to lovers arc or a one-bed scenario being in the book. And as Eleanor points out, the Empyrean uses many tropes popular on Book Talk.
There's a flawed but incredibly relatable female heroine. There's a handsome, brooding, emotionally repressed male lead. There's dragons.
All of the above. It's ticking all the boxes.
Yeah, so a book like that, a romantasy book, will do very well on Book Talk.
Tropes have been around for a very long time, hence the definition, and are almost like their own hashtags that make it easier for the TikTok algorithm to serve people content they will probably enjoy and to inform creators of what videos to make that will probably do well, meaning that a few books like the Empyrean series seem to be everywhere on BookTok. But what does that mean for real life? Are these books actually selling or being read?
The initial print run for one of Rebecca Yarros's books in the Empyrean series was 315,000 hardbacks. Now, to put that in context, for a trade hardback, anything over 75,000 is usually considered a very large print run.
Oh, wow.
I think another way that we can see BookTok as influencing consumer behaviour, if you walk into a branch of Dimmock, even Big W, you will see that they have sections dedicated to titles that are popular on BookTok. And the same if you go onto their website. They will have specific pages popular on BookTok.
Yeah, a little sticker on the book, you know.
Yep. You know, it's like a seal of approval. It's like a mark of quality. Well, this is popular on BookTok. It must be good.
And since publishers have traditionally controlled what does well and what doesn't, there have reportedly been attempts to try and gain some of that influence back.
Publishers are definitely attempting to start to control BookTok as a way of influencing consumer behaviour. And notable BookTokers have been very clear with their followers that they will not enter into paid partnerships. They will not accept any kind of incentive. They will continue to review and recommend what they genuinely love. And I think that that's going to be interesting to see how this continues to play out.
Another criticism of BookTok is that the same books are being recommended and that even new romance books are being published to cater to tropes that have become popular. Here's Mark Chong again.
This is at the heart of these data-driven systems. It tends to go with what the majority would go for. So it's pretty much, imagine in mathematical terms, it would just regress to the mean, the average, or what's most likely to be common. For example, in terms of books, what mainstream bestsellers have that's like, for lack of a better term, the key normal or what the average viewer would like to see or buy. So we can see this effect on the content being pushed on social network feeds, for example. What's most likely to engage most people?
Because you say an algorithm is a set of rules, is it not possible to code for variety or like diversity in literature?
That's a great question as well, because in some of the work that myself and some colleagues do, how do we increase, for example, diversity in things like search results? But that doesn't quite align with the whole ethos of recommendation, because if we recommend it, for example, more content that is not what many people would like to see, then not many people would engage with that content. And we go back to the chicken and egg problem, back to social media companies saying, hey, advertisers are not really keen on our platform because the more we recommend stuff, the less people look at it anyway. So might as well just regress to the mean, to borrow a mathematical expression.
So is it necessarily a bad thing that a lot of the books on TikTok are romance?
Controversial opinion maybe, but no, I don't think it does.
That's Eleanor again.
Reading is meant to be a pleasurable activity. It's something that makes you feel happy, makes you think, and helps you to connect to other people. And I think if what brings you joy is to read, you know, A Court of Thorn and Roses or Fourth Wing, then all power to you. I mean, of course, I think you should be reading other things as well. But I certainly don't think that we should be snobby about what people choose to read.
Dr. Eleanor Spencer-Regan from the University of Melbourne speaking to Amy Briggs. Next week on The Science Show, As humans evolved in Africa, so did the big cats that preyed upon us. I speak to a researcher who's looked into the kinds of predators that called our ancestors lunch. The Science Show is produced by David Fisher. I'm Belinda Smith.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.